Yes, Pastor. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, and good morning, everybody. We have Bruce Rawls on here with me, Lynn Johnson, and today we are going through the Journey Home with Dr. Kenneth Wapnick, and what a wonderful book this has been for us. Mm-hmm. The Journey Home, The Obstacles to Peace and A Course in Miracles, and very exciting, very enlightening every time we go through this. And so what's going on with Bruce? Are you still in California?
I am for a few more days, and next week I'll be back in Oregon. So
very nice. Well, next week hopefully we'll be joining on Zoom.
Oh, great.
Because
great.
I think I finally got the system set up so that I can actually do Zoom and Pal Talk at the same time.
Well, let's do a test as soon as you're ready so that we can just jump right in. How's that sound?
Yeah, and exactly. Great. And I think maybe next week that's where we'll be. We have done one little test, and we're going to have to figure out. I have a couple more things to figure out, but it ends up I'm using three computers now because the computer for the radio it has to stand alone. So it's okay. It's great that way. But so we'll have the radio, we'll have Zoom, and we'll still have Pal Talk for a while to give folks who are really into Pal Talk chance to check things out, and also because we do have some long-term people who sometimes go away for a couple months and then come back, and we don't want them coming back to an empty house. So
right.
So we will keep the Pal Talk going for a while, but as soon as we can move out of that, we will be doing that as well. So getting everybody on Zoom, not as hard as it seems.
Good.
I had to have a drink of my coffee. I just ran up the stairs my own self.
Oh, okay.
So so that's pretty
good. Watch out for those your own selves. Those they can be tricky.
Yes. My own self is pretty dang tricky, all right. Makes me think I have to run. Anyway, and so it looks like where we were in the book, I don't know about page-wise in your part, but we had just read to a thought about putting love there, choosing love.
Yes.
And so do you want to, you know where we're at, that's where we start?
Sure. I have us at the top of the first full paragraph at the top of page 88. We could back up as we often do and just read the quotes from the previous page.
Makes sense to me.
Which might make sense, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Ken prefaces these three quotes with saying that fear is always our responsibility and no one else's, and how it's emphasized early in the workbook lessons, albeit expressed in deceptively simple language, as we can see in the following excerpts. And he has three quotes here, all three of which are from the workbook, the first from lesson 15, and 16, and then 19. And the first one is, "It is because the thoughts you think appear as images that you do not recognize them as nothing. You think them, and so you think you see them. This is how your, quote, seeing, unquote, was made. This is the function you have given your body's eyes. It is not seeing. It is image making. It takes the place of seeing, replacing vision with illusions." That's from lesson 15, workbook. And then from lesson 16, the next one, "Everything you see is the result of your thoughts. There is no exception to this fact. There is no more self-contradictory concept than that of, quote, idle thoughts, unquote. What gives rise to the perception of a whole world can hardly be called idle." just a little humor there. Okay, and then the last one from workbook lesson 19. "You will notice that at times the ideas related to thinking precede those related to perceiving, while at other times the order is reversed. The reason is that the order does not matter. Thinking and its results are really simultaneous, for cause and effect are never separate, i.e., ideas leave not their source, as Ken puts in brackets there. Which you knew he was going to do that, right? Okay, so Ken says, so in summary, to, quote, put love there, unquote, is to choose love, which is the Holy Spirit, and this becomes the prayer to him. And then in quotes, please help me see the situation the way you do, unquote. I'm not sure if that's from the Course or from just, you know, Ken's saying, here's a good mechanism. If you need a model for prayer, here we go. Please help me see the situation the way you do. This is the most meaningful prayer we can ever offer. That is what A Course in Miracles means by saying that the only meaningful prayer is for forgiveness, because those who have been forgiven have everything. And of course, it's us forgiving ourselves ultimately for what never happened, and absolving ourselves from the unconscious yet unfounded guilt. Okay, so Ken goes on, says, this means that you do not deny what you see. You do not deny what is on the screen out there. And then he, in parentheses, he says, has right the right-hand side of chart A, which is a chart in this book, which is the Journey Home, of course, and that we're reading from. If you happen to have the hard copy of the book, you can find it there. Then he goes on, rather you deny your ego's interpretation of what your eyes tell you. I think that's such an important point. We're not denying the physical data, the neural impulses that go from the optic nerve, the auditory nerves into the brain, or the three sense organs. We're not saying that we deny all that. We just deny the ego's interpretation of all that data, which is, you know, gigabytes per second of data that we have streaming in to these machines we call bodies, you know, and we're just saying, you know, if we're following the Course's dictum and gentle suggestion, it's like, well, just maybe you could question the interpretations that have made you miserable for so long, right?
Yeah.
And then he finishes the paragraph with, it is never, emphasized, never, the world that is the cause of our anger or fear, but always, also in italics to emphasize, our interpretation of world, a truism within the perceptual world, is underscored by this important statement from the Manual for Teachers. And then the quote is, perhaps it will be helpful to remember that no one can be angry at a fact. It is always an interpretation that gives rise to negative emotions, regardless of their seeming justification by what appears as facts. So it's all of those appearances, and the appearances are our interpretations, aren't they?
Exactly. And what are these facts? Okay, let's just take an example of a fact, absolutely, that global warming is causing the polar ice caps to melt, and the melting of the polar ice caps is causing land masses that were normally above water to suddenly start becoming underwater to a certain extent, and that, you know, eventually if this were to happen, you know, perhaps a great portion of the world will be covered with water and there will be no place for people to live, and people will, it'll be like Waterworld in the movie. You know, that's a fact. That's going to happen. See,
the conjecture about the future may not be factual, but it's certainly based on the scientific data that's factual, right?
Right. It's based on scientific data that's factual, but we don't know.
Right.
We don't know. You know, I'm assuming that's what's going to happen.
Right. And, of course, what we think of as scientific data that's factual is really based on this, and this is the big elephant in the room that the Course keeps reminding us, is this assumes that the world is real,
yes,
and that it's important, and that it is where our identity is. And all those assumptions get us in a world, pun intended, of trouble.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so when we assume these things, we assume these, you know, that the fact is that life on Earth as we know it this moment can never be the same if it happens. You know, that may be a fact. However, the assumption that life on Earth as it is right now is the ideal way to be or the only thing that I can accept. Or, you know, think about the dinosaurs. You know, they had a lot of facts. You know, the fact is this is how we live and this is our life and this is the world. And, you know, this is, you know, we are going to reign here forever. And then, you know, boom, here comes some meteorite and, you know, puts that whole set of life forms out of business.
And that of course is probably factual, but you know, there's alternative theories that may actually come into play, like Gary Larson's cartoon showing the Tyrannosaurus Rex chain smoking and with the caption, "This is the real reason dinosaurs became extinct," right?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, because we can apply those facts to all sorts of things and make them reasons for the things that seem to be happening. But you know, the idea that the a fact is going to be responsible for, you know, my survival or not, you know, that the fact that I don't have any money in my bank account is going to say that, you know, my check is going to bounce, and those may be facts. But then I could go on and say, and then I'm ruined, my life is ruined, and I get evicted from my home, and I'm going to live in the street, and I'm going to have nothing. You know, those are all stories. So there may be a fact of, you know, how much money is in my account in relationship to how much money I owe somebody. That may be a fact, but my assumptions, the story that I make up that goes along with that fact, are the things that are, you know, causing me heartburn.
Yeah.
So
it seems like it all gets back to assumptions, isn't it? Because we assume that the world is real. We assume that our bodies are real. Now, again, we're not talking about on the level of form. We're talking on a metaphysical level here, because and everything that we say in these programs is really, you know, predicated on that. So if when we say it, you know, that the world isn't real, you know, we're talking from the Course's metaphysics, which suggests that in truth, that the truth of what we are in spirit, beyond space and time, beyond form and matter and energy and all the quirks to quasar realms of stuff that we think of make up the material world, and also the ego's, you know, phantom, phantasm universe of duality, that we've made that up too, and that's really the cause of the projected outer world. And once we start seeing the connection between those things and the fact that, you know, we were complicit in making up the ego in the first place, the idea of something apart from perfect oneness, then we have the opportunity to begin healing. And once we start practicing that, it becomes easier and easier to see the sameness in everything. And then it doesn't mean that the material objects in our sensory world go poof immediately. In fact, that's probably the very last thing to happen before, you know, as the Course puts it, you know, where God carries us over the threshold, or just, you know, that kind of metaphor, that, you know, because that's where we, you know, will end up. But for the time being, we have a whole lot of forgiveness to do, which is basically just challenging the assumption that this identity that, you know, of separate selves, the bruises and the limbs of the world, are the real identity, and just saying, well, maybe they're placeholders or substitutes for the real identity we all share. And if that's true, then it changes everything. It just totally turns the world upside down and makes it, instead of a prison, a classroom. Instead of being the victims of the world we see, and being at the mercy of the world we see, we suddenly become merciful to the world we see. And we recognize that we can choose what we want to give to the world, because we see it as our projection, and therefore it's our responsibility to choose a thought system that brings healing to that whole realm of our thinking by releasing our identity from it.
So. Yes, and it's so easy, I mean, that really is the way to do it, is to you know, allow our mind to be changed about what we think we're seeing, so and what we're identifying with, and we can, you know, I mean, that can happen. I can't do it by myself, but I can certainly ask the Holy Spirit to help me see and help me to realign my thinking. And it makes me think, you know, like this morning I got an email from Marianne Williamson's campaign manager. And of course we know Marianne. She's a student teacher of Course in Miracles. You know, she is, should be very, very, not, I'm saying should, that's a judgment on my part, very clear on the difference between what's real and what's not. And I'm reading this message from the campaign manager, and it says, the American people must decide, do you stand with Marianne for a moral economy? Donate now. Do you stand with Marianne for peace? Donate now. Do you stand with Marianne to make reparations for slavery and reparative measures toward Native Americans? Donate now. Do you stand with Marianne to address the humanitarian disaster of millions of traumatized children? Donate now. You know,
Well, yeah, another example of level of confusion, which is why I felt, you know, inspired to write a little essay on level of confusion and Marianne Williamson and what the course isn't, basically. And I have that on ACIMblog.com if anybody wants to read it. And I had fun putting it together because I wanted to start preface it with the fact that, you know, I felt profound gratitude to Marianne Williamson and several other early course proponents and teachers that you know, basically helped familiarize me with the course back in the late 70s to mid 80s when I finally cracked the books and actually read them and see what was in there. And, you know, anyway, and a lot of that guidance was very helpful. And over the years, it's become obvious that one of the things that's more challenging, which is why, you know, the more popular versions of some course teachings tend to take the form of, you know, fixing the world, changing the world, fixing the dream, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, Marianne's actually a fairly good example of that. You know, at the same time, I feel profound gratitude. And at the same time, you know, but we all do it. And so that's why I wanted to, you know, remind myself as I was writing this and hopefully, you know, when concluding that essay, tried to share that idea. I actually went back and added a little addendum there saying, you know, and it's important to make sure that as we think about these things, that we remember it's not someone else's level of confusion that's important. It's my level of confusion that I need to address. I need to look at the contents of my mind and where I'm still trying to make the dream world work for me and investing my identity and my peace of mind in outcomes that happen or don't happen in the world. And that's, I think, the pivotal difference is it doesn't mean we stop doing what we're doing in the world. In fact, we'd be silly to not do that. We'd be silly to stop eating or breathing or brushing our teeth or drinking water or the myriad things we do for our biological health, for our familial and social and community and global participation in the world. But just means we just take it a little less seriously in terms of how our peace of mind, our eternal spiritual innocence that we all have can never be compromised by what happens in this made-up dream drama of a world, right?
Exactly. And it just reminds me the reading, the text reading that's coming up here pretty soon, The Last Unanswered Question. And, you know, when I was reading those questions from Marianne's campaign manager, I was thinking these very questions. Ask these questions. Do I desire a world I rule instead of one that rules me? Do I desire a world where I am powerful instead of helpless? Do I desire a world in which I have no enemies and cannot sin? And do I want to see what I die because it's the truth? Donate now. No.
Well, as you're reading those questions, I couldn't help but thinking each one of those is ripe for the opportunity for level confusion. Because yes. If we think about each of those worlds that's being discussed there as being having anything to do with space or time or individuality, you know, or the whole thought system of guilt. That's why when one of Ken's commentaries on one of the workbook lessons, I came up with an acronym that I found helpful. It's GIST, G-I-S-T, for guilt, individuality, space, and time. And guilt, of course, refers to the whole ego thought system of sin-filled.
I
can talk without spoonerism. Yeah, sin, guilt, and fear, and death, and duality. And, you know, that whole craziness of the insecurity and the fallibility and the frailty and the limitation of the ego is a mental choice for insanity. And so that's the G in the GIST acronym for guilt. And then individuality is basically if I identify with something that's separate from someone else or different and not the same in terms of essence or spirit, if I think that somehow the differences are important, then I'm pushing spirit out. I'm pushing a real essence out of my identity by pushing someone else's out. It doesn't matter who or what it is. And then space and time, we can spend an hour each on that. anything having to do with space or time is just it intrinsically going to anchor us within the dream because, of course, in miracles and any other non-dual metaphysical system worth the salt will remind us that space and time are illusions, and modern physics does a pretty good job of taking us to that threshold as well. You know, so if we just really look at what's being said there, and so many of the mystical experiences, if not just the data from quantum mechanics pioneers from the last few decades, it's pretty obvious that we're making this stuff up. And mind is primary. It can't be left out of the equation anymore. Even physics has to acknowledge that. So that's why I think, inevitably and inexorably, we're drawn back to the mind. We're drawn back to the choice point in the mind, which Ken calls a decision maker. And it's really only referred to as such once in the text or once in the course. And just very, in a context that it sort of could easily be passed over, but Ken uses that, and Ken Wapnick uses that in his work so much to refer to that pivotal point where we're constantly choosing between the ego and the Holy Spirit, the ego being 100% insane and the Holy Spirit being 100% sane. And so we have moments of sanity, but we flip back and forth, with such rapidity we don't even pay attention, but it's almost like an intermittent circuit in the mind. It's on, off, on, off, on, off, and it sometimes flickers so fast we can't even detect how rapidly we go back and forth. But in those moments when we feel peaceful, we're choosing Holy Spirit's thought system of inclusion and sameness and release from condemnation and release from identification with that whole GIST world of guilt, individuality, space, time, and form, right?
That was beautifully stated, and thank you for that. And that GIST is a great thing to remind us that I'm getting the GIST of this. But I'm not trying to call out Marianne either because I don't have.
That's why I said we all do it. Exactly.
Yeah, well, and the fact is, it's in our script. You cannot forget that the things in this world are actually run by a script that was written long ago that had all of these situations, any particular situation that could come up that could cause any sort of level confusion or discomfort or upset or fear or joy or gratitude, any of those situations, really when you look at them from the point of view of the Holy Spirit, all you see is love. Whereas in the point of view of the world, you see, war and peace and political situations and people being mistreated and people being loved. And, you see all this variety of stuff from the point of view of the script. And that's the purpose of the script, and that's how it works. So, you can't blame someone from living out their script in the world. You couldn't, blame Lynn for, wanting to become an engineer because, she loved, biology and science and solving mysteries. And, you can't blame her for that. That's the character. That just like, I don't know if y'all, maybe you have been as, you seem to be kind of a nerdy guy like me, play Dungeons and Dragons, if you ever played that game.
Actually, that's my brother's experience. He got into that a while back, but I never did. But I know of it, so I know what it's about roughly.
So yeah, so it's about a story, and you're a character in a story, and you're living out the life of the character in the story, and you're doing what the character would do, and you're acting. You know, you're getting into trouble, and you're having to extricate yourself from all these situations, and you know that's really it's like. You know, there's a dungeon master that's figured out, which is the ego, has put together this story about, who I am and what I am in this particular world. And then, how I walk through that, that's, love is the way I walk in gratitude. I love the way that is said, is I walk in gratitude. I don't walk in fear. I don't walk in apprehension. I don't walk in thinking, who's going to hurt me next and what kind of trap am I going to fall into. If I'm walking in gratitude, walking in love, then I'm, walking with the Holy Spirit and walking with my brother.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what it's all about.
It is. And I think the way we return to that place in our mind is to just notice how ego's thought system really is about hate is the way I stumble in resentment. The antithesis of love is the way I rock in gratitude. Because that's really its whole modus operandi. And a few moments ago, you said something that kind of reminded me of the Big Bang and the tiny mad idea that the Course would use as its reference to that. And I was thinking, I might write a little essay about this and title it something like, would you hire this thought system or would you hire this guy and put the ego's CV or curriculum vitae or resume out and say, starting with the Big Bang, made up duality, appeared to have destroyed perfect oneness, and just let me, but have bullet points, like on a resume of all the accomplishments, the skills and abilities and accomplishments and starting from the tiny mad idea, through all the different splits, and all the different, mechanisms of ensnarement that the ego made up, and then basically if you spell it out the way it actually is in truth, who would want to hire this character? But we all did. Tag, we're all and that's the crazy irony of it, isn't it? We thought maybe there was something to this fantasy role-playing game, whether we call it Dungeons and Dragons or we call it duality, D&D maybe, the dualistic dungeon of dragons of dissociation, maybe disillusionment, but yeah, that's the ego's whole game, isn't it? It's just like, let's keep me involved in a fantasy role-playing game that has no positive outcome because someone has to lose. And as long as there's a win-lose in any game, we're basically playing out of the ego's handbook, out of its playbook. So
exactly. So that's that's why we're doing this work, is so that we can find another handbook. We don't have the dungeon player's guide or the dungeon master's guide. We have A Course in Miracles, and it's really what is telling us where to go and what to do and how to do it. Now, I don't have to know where to go, what to say, what to do, because He who sent me will direct me. That's to me the most freeing thing in the entire course. Really, honestly, I will say that over and over. I don't need to know, because I'll be directed. And I just have to listen to the direction. That doesn't mean I'm not going to go in that same direction. It means who I'm going in that direction with. Doesn't mean I'm not going to do the things I'm going to do. It's who I'm doing it with. And if I'm letting the Holy Spirit, guide, direct, not just guide, direct. That's a whole different thing to direct somebody. It is just telling me what to do and how to do it, whether I know it or not. So, it always works out perfectly. So,
and the course is really just a massive suggestion. It's just saying, you might want to try. There's no enforcement. There's no repercussions. There's no shoulds or oughts or implied guilt. In fact, the whole idea is to get us out of a thought system of guilt. So there's no coercion or manipulation whatsoever involved. And it really is the idea of extricating ourselves from the thought system of those crazy tactics and strategies. If we practice the course's curriculum, we'll feel better. And that's all it's saying is if you try this practice of mindfulness and choosing the teacher of kindness, the teacher of inclusion, the teacher of shared interest, and listen to that guidance consistently, you're going to feel better. You're going to be more peaceful. You're going to be more happy. And you're not going to be, buffeted around by every little thing that seems to happen in the world, because you recognize that your real identity doesn't live in the world. It couldn't live in something that was made up.
Exactly.
Because it is real.
And
our identity is real.
There's nothing to fear. That's the beautiful part of it. There's nothing to fear. I'm going to continue reading.
Please do.
Okay, so you just read that no one can be angry at a fact. It is always an interpretation that gives rise to negative emotions, regardless of their seeming justification by what appears in italics as facts. That's from the Manual for Teachers, section 17. So, from chapter 8. Or are you, okay, I'll let you catch up.
I read down. Maybe I'm lost here.
You just read this whole thing about it's never the world that's the cause of your anger or fear, and then
you're starting out with the Holy Spirit has given you His messengers.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Great. Very good.
Okay, and so this is from chapter 19 from the Obstacles to Peace. A quote that. From that, and it says, the Holy Spirit has given you His messengers to send to your brother and return to you with what love sees. They have been given to replace the hungry dogs of fear you sent instead, and they go forth to signify the end of fear. And so that is really where He's directing us. He's saying the messengers are the messengers of love, and they're sent to me and my brother, and it's up to me, even if my brother can't see it, it's up to me to see the love and replace the love, the hungry dogs of fear, with the love. Be the emissary of love, be the extender of love, and that is what happens. They go forth to signify the end of fear. Love is letting go of fear. I think Jerry Jampolsky's great book, and it really is exactly that. So Ken says, basically what Jesus is teaching us here, again, is that we have a choice, just as in the title of the last section of the text, Choose Once Again, chapter 31. We always have a choice of how we can look at a situation. This places the responsibility for our perceptions solely on ourselves. I'm responsible for the world I see. We say that all the time. Ken says, we are tempted by our ego's need to survive to see fear, hatred, or murder outside our minds. But we can always choose to ask Jesus' help to perceive the situation in another way. Needless to say, this is only possible when we relinquish our investment in being right, which is what sustains our individuality. Beginning with the next paragraph and continuing to the end of this section, here there are specific references to the ritual of communion, subtly correcting the traditional Catholic understanding of the Eucharist. I shall elaborate on these references as we get to them. So now we're going to talk about communion. And this from the, again, the Obstacles to Peace. Jesus says, love too would set a feast before you on a table covered with a spotless cloth, set in a quiet garden where no sound but singing and softly joyous whispering is ever heard. This is a feast that honors your relationship and at which everyone is welcomed as an honored guest. That's beautiful, and that's from The Obstacles to Peace. Love's
in fact, he says, it honors your holy relationship, meaning the relationship that we have with the Holy Spirit, which is reflected in our decision to see everyone as spirit and as all of spirit and as perfectly innocent. And every any moment that we choose that, we're engaged in the holy relationship, which is really, you know, a symbol of the oneness that we all are and share. But it's because we're in a world of duality, we need the symbols as a reference point to get back to that place in the mind, right?
Exactly, exactly. And so, you know, it is our being open to see that that really makes the difference. And allowing ourselves to be shown a different way. So Ken says, love's feast is the substitute for the ego's feast, quote-unquote, the hungry dogs of fear, and the quote-unquote table covered with spotless cloth is the table of forgiveness on which there is no sin. It is the holy relationship, the guilt of the special relationship replaced by the Holy Spirit's forgiveness, that brings us to this table. And so, yes, you're quite correct. It is the holy relationship that is what we are opening ourselves up for when we decide to drop the unholy relationship and allow the Holy Spirit to inform us. And isn't that, I don't know if you've read today's lesson, but that's pretty much what today's lesson is all about, too, is, you know, how I see my brother. Let me just take a real quickie peeky at it.
Want to read it?
Yeah.
Sure. It's let me not see myself as limited. It's pretty short, sweet.
Yeah.
Let me behold the Son of God today and witness to His glory and His being everyone. Let me not try to obscure the holy light in Him, including me, mm-hmm. the little self I think I am, and everyone else, and see His strength diminished and reduced to frailty, nor perceive the lacks in Him which I would, with which I would attack His sovereignty. And of course, the only sovereignty that makes sense is the sovereignty of perfect oneness. In the world of sovereignty, could take the form of appear to take the form of something being sovereign over something else. But the only sovereignty that the Course refers to is the sovereignty of the perfect oneness of non-dual essence that, you know, we all are. And then there's a little prayer at the end, and he says, He is your Son, my Father, He meaning in everyone that we think of, including ourselves, and today I would behold His gentleness instead of my illusions. He is what I am, and as I see Him, so I see myself. Today I would see truly that this day I may at last identify with Him. So when we identify with the spirit of everyone, and recognizing everyone is all of spirit, not just a part of it, and that spirit is completely innocent and is never defiled, abused, desecrated, folded, spindled, or mutilated, perfect oneness. When we recognize, you know, nothing of that happened, then we can afford to be really gentle with ourselves and with everyone. In our minds, and on the level form, you know, we may yank a misbehaving kid out from in front of an oncoming car and scold him, you know, out of love, or we may vote a politician who's misbehaving out of office out of love again. But when we do any of those things with any kind of mean-spirited intent, we're saying somehow this one person or this group of people or this part of the perfect sonship has been fragmented and has you know, messed things up, and therefore, I'm back to level confusion again. I'm back to, you know, ego's turf of making the dream real, and that's what gets us in trouble. So,
anyway. Yeah, absolutely, and it's such a beautiful gift to be able to shift this prayer. My God, you could use this prayer every day in every moment. Whenever you're around anyone, or if you see somebody on TV, or you read about them in a story, or, you know, someone tells you a story about something, just to be able to say, He is your Son, my Father, and today I would behold His gentleness instead of my illusions. He is what I am, and as I see Him, so I see myself. Today I would beseech you that this day I may at last identify with him. It's really, you want to identify with your brother. You want to connect with your brother. But if you see your brother as being, evil, then you don't want to connect with that. You want to connect with joy. And you want to connect with love. And this is why this particular lesson is so cool, because it's saying, okay, let me just stop seeing all these things that I've been accusing my brother of, even though the title says, let me not see myself as limited. The whole lesson is about how I see my brother. And then, obviously, the connection is how I see my brother is how I see myself. So if I want to see I want to see him in darkness. I want to see him weak. I want to see him as being an egomaniac. I want to see him as being a greedy, cruel person. Well, if I want to see my brother in any way that I'm perceiving as negative, that is how I'm going to see myself. This is how I'm going to identify myself with those same characteristics. That's why it's so important that we stop, focusing or projecting this madness onto our brothers, because it just splashes right back on us, and we can't see ourselves as being, like lesson 93 says, I think I'm the home of evil, darkness, and sin, even though the lesson says light and peace and joy abide with me. So,
exactly. That's just another example of how the Course, uses this cognitive dissonance, the psychological term of basically having us see side by side, juxtaposed on the altar of our mind, the two thought systems, fully exposed and revealed for what they are. And when you compare the thought system of inclusion with the one of exclusion, the thought system of love with fear, the thought system of forgiveness versus guilt, and side by side, the crazy one doesn't stand a chance. But it's only because we keep them separate in our minds. And we do this through level confusion and projection and all of ego's bag of tricks. But when we realize that, wait a minute, I do have control of my thoughts. I don't necessarily get to choose the thoughts in an absolute way, but I do so indirectly by choosing the thought system of either inclusion or exclusion, of either love or fear. And recognize that we have that choice of one of two thought systems, and not only does it simplify the process because it's just a binary decision, but also makes it clear that only one of them works, and we keep practicing the one that works more and more over time, and we become less and less invested, and therefore also, as a byproduct, less and less influenced by and subject to and the victim of the craziness of the ego. And so that's what eventually leads us to choose against the ego altogether. But we need to look at it and, put that close encounters beam from the spaceship on that thought system, which really is the light of the Holy Spirit, vaporizing the craziness of the ego. And when we allow ourselves to have that happen by choosing the right teacher, we feel more peaceful. That's pretty simple, isn't it?
It is pretty simple. And for me, I've kind of went through a period of time where I was going, well, I'm choosing to see peace, and yet all these people around me are seeing all this negative stuff, and I'm choosing to see love, and all these people around me are in fear. And it never dawned on me till not that long ago that, oh, if all these people around me are still seeing fearful things, that means I'm still seeing fearful things, because what I'm seeing is a projection of my own thinking. And so every single time I can go back to the mind and ask myself, why did I choose to see that particular thing? Or, always reminding myself, I'm the one who chose this. I'm the one who's choosing this. And, you know, when I look at other people and say, oh, man, you are so screwed up, think it's me.
Yeah, that reminds me of that thing I scrawled in big black block letters on computer paper, hanging in my bedroom as a teenager, just across town from where I'm at here in Livermore, California, and just before it might have been during the time it was being scribed, but it was certainly before it was published in my high school college era, and I remember looking at that every day. I'm choosing to feel this way. Big black block letters on the wall near the ceiling. And when I was having a great day, yeah, I'm choosing to feel this way. But when it really kicked in, when the message of that, you know, gift that I was given to write out and use as sort of a mantra until it became second nature, is like, oh, if I'm not at peace, I'm choosing to feel this way. And that's where it really became effective. It wasn't the euphoric fun stuff, but I think it, ultimately any feeling or thought that we've chosen, whether it seems to be something that makes us happy, it could be an ephemeral thing too, you know, a special love or a special hate, anything that is an apparent outcome is a choice. It's basically a choice of perception, a choice of teachers. And so, you know, over the years, the insights from that gift that I was given to put on the wall, you know, have become more and more obvious to me that, you know, I am always choosing how I want to feel and how I want to think, not in terms of the specific thoughts necessarily, although there's plenty of opportunity for, plenty of range there. But I think the important distinction and what keeps it simple and it keeps our mind uncluttered and clear and keeps it simple is that we just have to choose the right teacher. And there's only two,
yep.
And guess what? One of them doesn't exist.
Yeah, yep. And it's real easy to tell once you have some discernment. Mm-hmm. It's real easy to tell whose voice you're listening to.
Exactly. So we need to look at how we're feeling. We need to not deny our thoughts, not deny our feelings, not deny all the stuff that runs through our mind, but just say, hey, Holy Spirit, you judge this for me. I'm gonna mess things up if I am left to my own devices as an ego, as a separate self. But Holy Spirit, you know, the mind that I brought with me into the dream to get me out of this crazy labyrinth of darkness, you know, you look at this for me and lead me back out into the light by, you know, disinterpreting, you know, reinterpreting ego's misinterpretations and helping me get back to the mouth of a cave and out into the light again.
Exactly. So let's continue.
Yeah.
We have a few more minutes. So I'm going to continue reading. This is just a little aside thing, which I think is pretty cool, but it's very, very sweet. It says, incidentally, we are occasionally asked, this is Ken, by the way, asked here at the Foundation if there is a prayer in A Course in Miracles that would be suitable as a grace before meals. So we were just reading about the holy relationship at the table. So he says, this paragraph is the one I usually suggest. And again, I guess this must be from The Obstacles to Peace. It says, and in holy instant grace is said by everyone together as they join in gentleness before the table of communion. And I will join you there as long ago I promised and promise still. For in your new relationship, I am made welcome. And where I am made welcome, there I am. Wow. And that just reminds me of even from the New Testament, where Jesus says, wherever two or more of you are gathered in my name, there I am. That was a literal thing. That was not a, by the way, you know, you can imagine me here. He's saying, you know, you and I right now gathered in his name, everyone listening here to this gathered in his name. He is here. Jesus is here right now. And he's always here. You know, he's always here. I just don't recognize it so much of the time. But if I'm just realizing, you know, Jesus is right here and welcome, thank you so much for being here with us today, Mr. Mm-hmm. Jesus.
And again, this we're talking about a symbol in the mind. We're never talking about form or anything having to do with guilt, individuality, space, or time. In these conversations, we're always talking about the place in the mind where we get to choose against insanity and for the peace of sanity of the Holy Spirit, which is symbolized in A Course in Miracles by its author, Jesus. And it has nothing to do with necessarily the Jesus of the Bible, because it represents a very different thought system.
Right. But it is the Holy Spirit is the mind that is, you can call it whatever you want, but it's the same thing everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So then Ken says, communion means to join with each other, to come together. And one of the things that Jesus says more than once in A Course in Miracles is that he stands within the holy relationship, which does not mean that he is not also present in the special relationship. Jesus must always remain within our minds, whether we choose to leave them or not. However, the guilt that we have chosen in the special relationship obscures his presence so that we are no longer aware of him. So, you know, and this is quite true. Jesus is always here. He's in every relationship. It's whether we notice it or not, whether we are aware of it or not, whether we welcome it or not, whether we want it or not. You know, this is the whole thing. You know, there are some times that, you know, Jesus, I don't really care for you to be around here right now because I want to be mad. You know, it's not going to go away. The right mind is not going to leave us because we decide that we want to think with the wrong mind. The right mind is always with us, and that's what Jesus really is, the right mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether you're a person or not.
Yeah. You know, as you're reading that, the one phrase that really grabbed me, and I think this is such an important one, which does not mean that he is not also present in the special relationship. And I was just thinking, well, those are, you know, when we're having our idle thoughts, when we're off in our own dreamland of duality, Jesus is sort of like on hot standby. And that's a phrase that I learned when I was working in the electronics industry, making video routing switchers for the broadcast industry at a company called Grass Valley Group a few decades ago now. And one of the things that we did in these routing switchers was, in order to have a fail-safe system, if there was any problem with the power supply, in a split second, in fact, less than that, if one power supply would fail, the other one was called diode ored in, so that the other power supply would take care of the whole system without anything even noticing the slightest hiccup, because it was there ready to, at the slightest invitation, if you will, to get rid of the false alternative. It was there to pick up the slack. And, you know, just like the Maytag repairman, you know, waiting for the call. And, but not asleep, you know, always vigilantly ready to step in a split second. And if one of the boards in the system that I was designing were to have a component failure or whatever, or just something were to go wrong, it was basically set up so it would detect if one of the video signals dropped out from that board within one vertical interval or one, you know, 60th of a second, something like that. It would drop the other board and go to the backup board, which was carrying the same signal. So it was basically, you know, it basically was one of these things that the equipment manufacturers realized that they were going to lose a lot of revenue from advertisers for the people that bought these routing switchers if they had to go off air. So reliability was of the utmost importance in these systems. And so I learned a lot about that. And the phrase that was used was, well, we have another backup board and a backup power supply for every part of the system. And they were called on hot standby, meaning that, you know, they could switch over in either instantaneously in the case of a power supply or within a, you know, like a tiny fraction of a second if it was if the signal coming out of that board, one of the boards in the system failed. So I thought it was kind of interesting metaphor, you know, that Jesus says, you know, or that Ken says that Jesus is always on hot standby, or basically he's always present in our special relationship. So if anything, you know, in any given moment when we're ready to say, okay, I've been miserable enough, I give up, I'll try your approach now again, because I haven't been at peace. I could see peace instead of this, you know. And I'm willing to consider that I haven't been upset for the reason I thought. So let's hear your reason, Jesus.
Exactly. I love that idea of Jesus being on sort of like a backup generator or a,
oh yeah,
you know, I mean, very definitely there's so many symbols in the world that will remind you that, you know, he's always there waiting, and it's our invitation that allows him to come in, sort of like a vampire at the door. Just kidding.
I'm not sure about that analogy, but
well, yeah, not all vampires follow that rule. Anyway,
should we read one more paragraph?
Okay,
Page?
Okay.
All right. The guilt, therefore, is like a veil that hides Jesus from our experience. Choosing forgiveness instead of guilt removes the veil, and so we recognize him who is always there. Thus, Jesus is saying that he will join us there does not mean that he's not already there. The words here really mean that we are now joining with him in the place in our minds he never left, but which we in our insanity left in that original instant. And what Jesus waits on is our welcome. Elsewhere in the text, he says that, quote, love waits on welcome, unquote. We were just talking about that. So again, this passage does not mean that love or Jesus is not fully present in our minds, but it does mean that we will not be aware of his loving presence until we choose to welcome it in. So I think that's a really important point, is that it's not like that awareness is that presence is absence. It's just that we have blocked it out. We made up the world as a way to keep that oneness out, because we know that if we listen to that voice for peace, that voice for oneness, the voice for inclusion and sameness, consistently, the self that we made up, that we're so invested in, you know, that not invented here, part of our mind, is basically ultimately going to be vaporized. But we hang on to all the little shreds and scraps of hopes and expectations and plans for making the world work. And, whether they're conscious or unconscious, and I think a lot of them are unconscious, but, you know, there's still places in our mind where we hold on to things that aren't going to work.
Yeah.
I just missed the clock, and we're about out of time. Can I make a quick announcement?
Absolutely, please do.
Sure. Yeah, yesterday hit the email list. If anybody wants to subscribe to aciblog.com, there's a subscribe function there. Neat free list. And anyway, Thursday afternoon I had a wonderful conversation with Dr. Bob Rosenthal, one of many, and we decided, let's just trust guidance to see where it goes. And we went all over the map in terms of fun topics and just had a blast talking about all kinds of things for about an hour. And so if you want to check that out, that's at the top of the left column on aciblog.com. And that's Bob Rosenthal, Dr. Bob of Foundation for Inner Peace, who's one of the co-presidents. And I always encourage people to check out acim.org, which is the Foundation for Inner Peace website, and also facim.org, which is the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, Ken Welk's organization, that's now being carried on wonderfully by Jeff Siebert, who's doing weekly classes. If you haven't checked those out, highly recommend it. Oh, and one last thing, there's still room, I believe, in Doug Sparks' Mexico trip. If you want to, you know, quickly book a flight to Ajijic, actually to Guadalajara, and then make the connections up to Ajijic at Lake Chapala. He's doing a wonderful workshop there for 4 days at Lake Chapala, in near where both David Hoffmeister and James Twyman have done a lot of work there with different groups. So anyway, if you're interested in checking it out, go to DougSparksACIM.com, and you can sign up for his email list, highly encouraged, and also contact him through his contact form, which we just fixed last night. We didn't realize there was a problem. So anyway, thanks again, all as always. Have a wonderful week, and next week I'll be talking to you from back in Oregon.
All right.
Love to everyone.
Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. And all right, now I'm going to let go of the mic and turn it back over to the room to Carrie and Iris. And Bruce, if you want to hang on for a minute, I'm going to run shot off the recorder, and I'd like to talk to you for a minute.